move on to our final session. And in this session, what we want to do is talk about more the way forward, going ahead. What do we do from here? This is, I think, a very difficult and challenging question. I mean, if you've actually really heard what I've said, and not just heard it, but if you actually in some way assent to it, agree with it, then I think you realize that's very dramatic changes are required in the life of the ecclesia in order for it to recover something very fundamental to its own identity, its own life. I don't think we should hide from that, but I also don't think that we should allow ourselves to get discouraged by it. This is just my own personality and my own, it's kind of like my calling in life, in that I think my motto has always been, if something is not nearly impossible, it's not worth doing, you know, or not worth trying. I think the idea of trying to undertake something which is which involves an enormous effort, which is a massive investment, and which if achieved would be revolutionary in a certain way. I mean, that's part of I think of just of who I am, but it's not part of who everyone is. But what I think we all need to recognize, if these things are true, then we have to settle in for what really will require perhaps generations in order for change to be the kind of change to be affected that we're seeing here, that we're talking about here. Just as Gamaliel said to in the counsel he gave to, you know, the Sanhedrin regarding the apostles, you know, if this is of God, if something is going on among us, if we're seeing something which is not only true but which is part of something the Holy Spirit is trying to say to the ecclesia, then it will take effect. It will happen. And we can have confidence and faith, even if it's not in our lifetimes. And that's my attitude towards this project in general, and just one that I urge you to all consider for yourself. An attitude of faith, an attitude of settling in for the long haul, so that you don't get discouraged when you don't see dramatic changes in a week or a year. In this respect, I've found my involvement in dialogue with Roman Catholics to be very, very helpful, because Roman Catholics think in terms of centuries, you know? Yeah. Protestants tend to think in terms of decades or years or weeks or days, at least in America. I shouldn't make these comments so much. I don't know if it's different with Protestants in the Netherlands, but
evangelicals think it should be done yesterday.
And so this is a task which it's so massive and so profound that it is one that we have to think about in the long term. But we have to start now. Now, if we again think about that statement of Pope John Paul II, to when we encounter Jesus, we encounter Judaism. Then my question, if we're not encountering Judaism, are we encountering Jesus? What this implies is that there's a kind of imperative built into the gospel message itself and the very calling vocation of all of those who bear the name of Jesus to encounter Judaism. This is simply part of who Jesus is, especially if Jesus, as I've been arguing, and I think was, as John Paul was also presuming, has continued on to continue to impact and shape the life of Judaism itself of the last 1900 years. It's not just a matter of encountering first century Judaism. That's often the way we can think about it. You know, encountering Jesus is to encounter the Judaism of the past, of the biblical past. But if Jesus is continuing to shape the very life of the Jewish people and the life of Jewish tradition, then we need to encounter the living Judaism, that's been carried by the Jewish people and continues to be carried by the Jewish people today. So this requires living engagement with other Jews to the extent possible. I say to the extent possible because there are not Jews living in every place where there are Christians. It can't be the case that every Christian community has to develop this deep and intimate and vibrant connection with a Jewish community, because there are, if you're a Christian in rural China or South Korea, or someplace in Africa, it's not going to happen. But that does not mean that Chinese Christians or Korean Christians or African Christians somehow are exempt from some kind of encounter with Judaism. And it's actually striking. There's a great interest in China and in South Korea and places in Africa in Judaism. And with it's all, again, I think this is simply a work of the Holy Spirit. I think if there are no living Jews in one's area, there is still the possibility of studying, of learning, of trying to understand both the Judaism of Jesus' day and the Judaism of today and the Judaism of the last 2,000 years. It's not a matter of every Christian or every Christian leader needing to become a deep scholar of Judaism. That's not going to happen. But there's no reason why it should not be a normal thing for Christian pastors to be reading Abraham Joshua Heschel or Martin Buber or Jonathan Sacks. I mean, these are great Jewish thinkers of the 20th and 21st centuries who have so much to say. So much to say. And when you encounter their living voices, you're encountering the voice of the Jewish people, the voice of living Judaism, and I would say an aspect or an echo of the voice of Jesus himself. So there's something about the curriculum of Christian life. You know, I believe that Daniel, you do some teaching in the school here on Judaism and Jewish-Christian relations. I think every Christian seminary should be studying, should have a requirement of studying Judaism and studying Jewish-Christian relations. It's not a matter of an external connection. You see, it's not like just bettering your relationships with another religion. It's not another religion. You know, it's part of who you are. And if you want to understand who you are, you better get in touch with this reality. So, this imperative of studying and learning about Judaism, which I think, again, applies to to Christians wherever they are. This, I think, has to, though, go in hand in hand, as I was arguing in my last presentation, with an attempt, at least, to recover or nurture the emergence of a bilateral ecclesiology. What that means, of course, is nurturing and fostering the development of a mature form of Messianic Judaism. Now, I'm stating that carefully because I don't think Messianic Judaism as it currently exists, by and large, is very mature. I'm not simply saying go to wherever there's a Messianic Jewish congregation and that should be your reference point for the emergence of this bilateral ecclesia. The fact is, of course, that today in many Messianic Jewish congregations, there are very few Jews there. Messianic Judaism is not just about Jewish things. It is about Jewish people. If there are no Jewish people present, you do not have Messianic Judaism. You may have a kind of Christian return to Jewish roots, which may in itself have some real value. So I'm not trying to discount whether it's good or say whether it's good or whether it's bad. But to simply say that the fact that you have a group of Christians who are seeking to do Jewish things, that's not Messianic Judaism. That is, as I said, a kind of a Jewish roots expression of Christianity. And I think what needs to be fostered is the development of communities of Jews who are disciples of Jesus, who are seeking to also be more than just an evangelistic arm of the church. Yes?
I'm a bit confused. When you earlier stated when Christians suppress Jews,
yes,
they deny them their Jewishness,
yes,
that's wrong.
Yes.
And now you say there's nothing wrong when Christians from the heathens,
Gentiles,
be Messianic,
yeah,
Jews.
Yeah.
Pretend to be,
yeah,
Messianic. So.
Yeah. No, I'm trying to be very careful here, in that I'm reluctant to just condemn whole groupings of people, and it means that I'm maybe being a little more careful before the camera than I would be in a private conversation. First of all, I think there's something very problematic when you have a group of non-Jews who are claiming to be Jews, or claiming to have a Messianic Jewish, or pretend, whatever it is. Yeah, no, I think that is a real problem. What I'm saying is, if you had, you could potentially have, I think, some Christians, Gentiles, who, in an effort to express the importance of the Christian connection with the Jewish people, as Christians, adapted certain Jewish practices with the understanding that those were not obligatory or were not things that the church as a whole was required to do. Those are a lot of qualifications, and I'm trying to be open to these, to the possibility that there might be something positive in such settings. I'm not actually particularly enthusiastic even about those. But I'm trying to be open to, maybe I'm being like Justin Martyr, you know, but...
I sense a lot of confusion in our churches, people discovering,
sure,
Israel,
yeah,
and telling us, well, we should keep,
yes,
keep peace,
exactly,
celebrate Shabbat.
Right, and this is, yeah, that, and this is very clearly not my message. I think that there are ways I put it in some presentations I gave earlier this week is that I think Torah practices for Jews are commandments. For Gentile Christians, they're wisdom. And by wisdom, I mean they're the things that should not be ignored. They should be studied. They should be appreciated. And then the question should be asked, what is there that can be learned and translated into other settings and environments? But that's different than treating it simply as a commandment. But it's also not just saying, oh, it's for them, and it doesn't have any kind of meaning for us. But there's a greater sense of freedom in the way in which you relate to it as a Christian. And I think this is true even of something like the Sabbath. I think that the Sabbath is not a commandment for Gentiles. Again, I've said this before in this past week, which is sort of shocking for people because of this absolute assumption so strongly rooted in Christian tradition that the Decalogue is the universal statement of requirements for the church. I don't think it is. I think the Decalogue is intrinsically bound up with the framework of the covenant, covenantal requirements of Israel, and you know that's you have to look more at other traditions such as the Noahic commandments, and then the commandments incumbent then on the Gerim, the strangers who live in the midst of Israel. To get at more the sorts of things that are truly obligatory for Gentiles and for Christians. I actually think that there's a problem. Then, in addition to that, there are some commandments which I think are so particular to the Jewish people that Christians, in a certain sense, except in very, very rare cases or unusual, exceptional cases, are simply not supposed to do them. And that's where you get something like circumcision on the eighth day as an entry into the covenant. You know, I think the reason Paul is so insistent about this in the letter to the Galatians is both because it can communicate a sense that Jesus is not enough. It tends to denigrate the act, the work of Jesus. The other side, as a Jew, it tends to move in the direction of a new kind of replacement theology, a Torah positive replacement theology, you know, where Christians simply become the ones who are the real keepers of the Torah, and where you no longer even need Jews anymore. So, yeah, enough on that, I guess. For now, but I'm glad you asked the question because it has come up in all of my presentations this week. It's clearly a very live issue that you all wrestle with here in the Netherlands. So it hasn't been part of my actual presentations, but it's obviously important to be addressed. Now, in terms of this engagement with Messianic Judaism, particularly with, let me just say, it's not a technical term, but post-missionary Messianic Judaism, the church finds itself, I think, in a very delicate and difficult spot. The reason is, on the one hand, I think there is an imperative for you to be engaging with the Jewish world as a whole, and that means building relationships and building trust with the wider Jewish world in such a way that the Jewish world is very clear. You're not just there to evangelize them. You are there also to learn from them, and you are there because you have the sense that you belong together, that you're a family, and that you're trying to recover a relationship that's been damaged, and at times lost. You know, so on the one end you're doing that, but on the other hand, if you're trying to relate seriously to Messianic Jews, and not just relate, but have a sense that there's this imperative to restore a Jewish expression of life within the ecclesia, that gets interpreted by the wider Jewish world as a kind of violation of your trust with them. It gets interpreted as engaging in mission, because that's the only category the wider Jewish world has. The wider Jewish world has not yet really comprehended that there are forms of Messianic Judaism which are not just Jews for Jesus, that are not just Christian missions. And so this is a it puts Christians in general, I think, in a delicate position. But I am in my view, you're not exempt from doing both of those things. I thought I might share with you a little bit experience here in dealing with the Catholic world, the Catholic Church, because I think it's just very instructive. I think they are the pioneers here. It's interesting. In many ways, they've been pioneers in the Jewish-Christian relations sphere as a whole. You know, Nostra Aetate, the Vatican II document that deals centrally with relations with the Jewish people, is a real groundbreaking statement that had sent waves, ripples through the rest of the Christian world. I think that the approach the Catholics are taking to Messianic Jews is the same. It's also, I think, something that should set a precedent that then becomes more normative in the rest of the Christian world. We all know that the Catholic Church has been very serious about Jewish-Christian dialogue ever since Nostra Aetate. They established a commission in the Vatican for dealing with relations with the Jewish people. And it's interesting, you know, they had these two different departments. They have one department that deals with ecumenical relations, with relations between the Catholic Church and other churches. And then they have another department that deals with the Catholic Church's relation to other religions. And so then the issue is, where were they going to put the department for dealing with the Jewish people? It went in the department that deals with ecumenical relations. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that is a kind of statement. I think now there were some reasons for that that weren't just theological, but I think there's a kind of prophetic or theological message in it from the very beginning. From that point, the Catholics quite aggressively pursued this matter of Jewish-Christian relations. And I was talking yesterday to a Catholic scholar at the Free University, and she was saying that one of the things she noticed was that in Catholic institutions where they were teaching seminarians, it was understood to be just basic that you had to teach Jewish-Christian relations. This was an essential part of the curriculum, whereas it was an exception or unusual in Protestant settings. I'm very pleased that you're doing it here, but I think you're somewhat exceptional in that. So, the Catholics were already the pioneers on this. In the late 1990s, a group of Messianic Jews were able to meet with then Cardinal Ratzinger. In that meeting with Cardinal Ratzinger, they presented themselves as Messianic Jews. And the response of Cardinal Ratzinger was, if you are who you say you are, this is an eschatological sign. Pretty remarkable thing, you know, for someone of his position to say, particularly someone who's let's say, temperamentally cautious, as we saw in his papacy. You know? After that, a group of Messianic Jews developed a close relationship. This is a group of Messianic Jews in Israel, developed a close relationship with the theologian of Pope John Paul II. Every pope has a personal theologian who's always a Dominican. It's called, and the position is called the theologian of the papal household. They live close to the pope, and they're the personal advisor of the pope on theological matters. So it was this particular person, his name it was Cardinal Cotier, and he was Swiss, and he developed a close connection with Messianic Jews and then was in close communication with Pope John Paul II about it. They decided to launch a kind of secret confidential dialogue with Messianic Jews, which began in the year 2000. And it was secret because of the fear that the Catholic Church, the justified fear, I think, that the Catholic Church had, that in some ways their relations with the Jewish world, which they treasured and were, they saw as so important to them, would be endangered by entering into conversation with us. I think they also felt like that the purpose of this conversation with us was to discern whether they thought we really were who we said we were. They hadn't concluded it, but they thought we might be, and they thought it was worth their investment enough to talk to us at this on this level. That in itself, I thought, was just amazing. I mean, to have people at the highest levels of the Catholic Church who are dealing with billions of people, you know, and the problems they have to deal with, you know, oy, you know, I mean, they've got really big stuff to deal with. And here you have this little movement, this Messianic Jewish movement, which is so fragmented and so weak and so honestly unimpressive. And yet, they thought it was of great importance to discern us. Now, I happen to think they were right. I mean, I believe that we are that important. On the other hand, I can also look at it through external eyes and say, you have to be, you have to be almost a prophet in order to see it. You know, they thought it might be the case, and so for 7 years we met, rotating between Jerusalem and Rome. And we prayed together, we studied together, we argued together. They got a sense for who we were and what we were about. And so after 7 years, and again, the Catholics, things move slowly in the Catholic world. At a certain point, we got a little impatient. We Jews were a little more, we're not quite as patient as our Catholic friends. So we said, okay, we think you've had enough time. What do you, give us your decision. What do you think? You know, and they huddled together and talked, and they said, "Well, no, we think we can. We think you are who you say you are. We think this is a movement of the Holy Spirit. It's not. We don't think it's just another Protestant sect. You know, we think there's something happening here, which is a movement of the Spirit in the midst of the Jewish world, and we think it's of great significance for the life of the Church." We said, okay, well, where do we go from here? And they said, well, we can now start talking about this. It can be public. It doesn't have to be private. But we have to emphasize that it's informal and that it's an initiative of a set of individuals rather than an official initiative of the Catholic Church. So it was still this early stage of things, because those who had concluded that they believed, they had discerned and they believed this was a work of the Holy Spirit, you know, they weren't all of the official apparatus of the Church. Now, it included some pretty high-ranking people, obviously, and it appeared that the Pope was really among them, but, you know, the Pope doesn't just dictate things like this. The Pope has to build on the sense of what's emerging in the life of the Church. He can't just impose his reading of these sorts of movements on his community before the rest of the community has dealt with it in any way. And so they said, okay, the next process is we have to try to expand the reach of this, get other people involved, get other people aware of what's going on with the Messianic Jewish movement, get Catholics to know about Messianic Jews, get Messianic Jews more acquainted with Catholicism and less reactive to it. So we worked on that a bit for the second 7 years, and I published an article that was dealing with this dialogue that appeared in First Things, an ecumenical but largely Catholic journal in the United States, and to get a conversation going. So we made some progress. At the end of that 14 years, which was last year, we said, okay, we think this phase of things is done. The Catholic Church has to decide, is it ready now to take the next step, which means moving this onto a more formal and official level. And that's the stage we're at right now. And while it hasn't been finalized, I think it's actually looking very, very promising. Pope Francis seems to be just as enthusiastic, just as positive, and have the same kind of attitude towards us that Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II have. Remarkable. Three popes in a row who are all discerning that there's something of importance here, and to the point where they're willing to take risks. I think they believe that it won't totally destroy their connections with the Jewish community, but they think it's important enough that they've got the courage that I think they're going to be willing to take the next step. We'll see. If they do, and if it's a public, obviously it will send ripples again through the entire Christian world and the Jewish world. So now I share with you at length about that because I think it's a model. Isn't it remarkable that the Catholic Church is the only ecclesial body in the world that has taken this initiative? You know, that has been willing to do this, which has been so assertive in pursuing Jewish-Christian relations, and at the very same time has been willing to make this kind of investment in engaging with the Messianic Jewish movement, and now I think to begin to take the risks that will be entailed by being in relationship with us. There are such risks. The Messianic Jewish movement is we're not respectable, you know? My whole life as a scholar has been dealing with this fact, you know? It's trying to break through into respectable company, you know, when I'm really not respectable myself in terms of the movement that I represent and for which I advocate. So these are the kinds of things I think that the Church needs to be doing. It's both this pursuing of its connection with the Jewish people as a whole. It's trying to deepen its knowledge of Judaism and realizing how intrinsic Judaism is to the very life of the Church without simply becoming Jews and adapting Jewish practices. And then the nurturing, the fostering of a Messianic Jewish life, of a Jewish presence within the Ecclesia, as both a kind of act of reparation for the past suppression of Jewish life, but really, even more importantly, as an act of attempting to recover the Church's own identity as this extension of the life of Israel. Now, just a final comment. I think, in my sense of things, this is this both recovery of the Jewish dimension of the life of the Ecclesia and this engagement with the Jewish people has profound implications and consequences for the unity of the church. And now, for 20 years, I was part of an ecumenical community. It was a community founded by Catholics, but it was basically two-thirds Catholic, one-third Protestant. And the Protestants in it were from the whole gamut, the whole variety of Christian denominations and non-denominations, and some of us who were Messianic Jews. And in that community, what I came to develop was a sense of the importance of recovering the unity of the Ecclesia. There was something scandalous about the fragmentation of the Ecclesia, and that it we really shouldn't be justifying it and in some ways painting, whitewashing it by talking about all the beautiful variety that is manifest through it. You know, that there's really, I think, something heartbreaking about the divisions among the disciples of Yeshua. Now, what we experienced in this ecumenical community was we had the sense that what was fundamental to our relationship with one another was not our doctrinal unity. That we could have this variety of different doctrinal positions, which we could hold and even think were in many ways important. In other words, we could really have disagreement with one another, and yet there was something fundamental about being disciples together of Jesus that we could do in our daily life. And so we had people who were part of all these different communities in the sense of church groupings, and even Messianic Jews, and yet in daily life, we served and lived together, and we're trying to bear witness to something that we thought was important for the entirety of the people of God, of the Ecclesia. Now, I happen to believe that the root of all of the schisms and ruptures in the life of the Ecclesia was the rupture with the Jewish people, and you know, one of the remarkable things about the Jewish people is that it manages to maintain a sense of solidarity and common identity and mutual help among groupings of people who don't agree about almost anything. You know, there's incredible disagreement about what it means to be a Jew and what Judaism means. And it gets expressed in all these different parties and different groups and different denominations, and then Jews who are part of no denomination at all or no Jewish group. And yet, something happens in which Jews in some place are in danger. Jews throughout the world basically come together, send aid together, organize together. The whole Jewish communities meet as communities, wherever they are, across every line. And, you know, that's something about what it means to be part of a people. And I think that in some ways the Ecclesia, when it lost its connection to the Jewish people, lost that sense of being rooted in the life of a people. And so its unity from that point on was totally dependent on absolute doctrinal homogeneity. And I think that this has led to many, many other things in the history of the church. I believe that we should couple our zeal for the recapturing of the Jewish identity and of the Ecclesia with a sense of a zeal for the importance of the unity of the whole Ecclesia. And I've seen in my own experience in this ecumenical community, when One of the ways we tended to bypass some of the cultural problems and differences between the different communities was by introducing certain kinds of Jewish practices translated into a different mode. And it kind of bypassed some of the problems that the different Christians had with one another. I think sometimes we can restate certain things in Jewish terms, and some of the problems and the disagreements seem a little less formidable, less impossible. You know, for example, there's ways of talking about the Lord's Supper and what goes on in the Lord's Supper that build upon certain Jewish categories that you can actually you can get agreement from Protestants and Catholics alike, and then they can turn to one another and often understand one another better. That's just a simple illustration. So I believe that what this is all about, what we're talking about here, is not just dealing with Judaism. If this is really so integral to the very identity of the church, the very identity of the ecclesia, then it has to spill over and have implications in every other sphere of the life of the ecclesia. And most importantly, I believe, in this area of the unity among the people of God as a whole. We've only got 2 or 3 minutes left. Is there anything that anyone is desperate to get out that they want to ask me before we conclude? Yes.
Well, you were talking about circumcision. A circumcision, yes, is a kind of a sacrifice. But there are a lot of sacrifices to be done by Jews. I think the Hebrew Bible, which, by the way, is translated all over the world by the Ecclesia.
Yes, that's right.
Is actually anti-sacrificial. So what's your opinion about bringing sacrifice? Like a red cow or so.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, of course, again, I look at the clock and say, okay, 60 seconds to answer that question. But I think, yes. Yeah. No, it's, no, it, and it's an important question. I think that, obviously, apart from circumcision, in Jewish life, we do not have blood sacrifice right now. But the fundamental category of sacrifice, what I think both what circumcision, now, I build very much on the writing of the teaching here of the Jewish theologian Michael Visegrad. And if any of you have never read him, he's one of those Jewish writers. He's got to be on your list. He was actually very influential on Kendall Solon. I read his book, either Abraham's Promise that Kendall edited, or The Body of Faith. But in The Body of Faith, he argues that the sacrifices in the temple were themselves but a kind of pointer to the true sacrifice. The true sacrifice was Israel's body itself. That circumcision also, in effect, points to martyrdom. That martyrdom is the core reality behind all sacrifice. It's about this offering of one's life fully to God. And that what Visegrad argues is that Israel itself is the ultimate sacrifice, the ultimate korban. The blood sacrifices were kind of like substitutes for that and expressions of that offering. But you know, in the day when there's no temple, Israel still itself is a sacrifice, is a korban. That's fundamental to its identity. I would say it's also fundamental to the identity of the church. And this is a great illustration of Israel Christology, because what I would argue is that Visegrad is right. This is the meaning of sacrifice. This is the central identity of Israel. And Jesus, as the microcosm of Israel, as the one man Israel, as the one who sums up and perfects all that Israel is the ultimate sacrifice, such that his sacrifice is not to be disconnected from either the sacrifice of Israel or the sacrifice of the martyrs of the church. That would be the conclusion.
Thank you, Dr. Kinzer. Let me state this in a Jewish way. Is to be allowed to sit at your feet for a couple of moments and for accepting our invitation to come here and to have these lectures. You are blessed, I know. Especially, I'm thankful for the balanced way you introduced this into tricky subjects and controversial issues, etc. Thank you so much, because this is an attitude that you also offers us here a possibility to identify with you. We hope we all did. As a small token of our appreciation, I would like to give you this book written by Ian Randall, one of our keen historians, about communities of conviction. We are a communal identity as Baptists, Baptist beginnings in Europe. Wonderful. Thank you once again.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be with you all. It really is.
Hopefully, please.